I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times.
It is time to show Washington, D.C., both my fellow Democrats, who I hope will stand with us, and the Republicans who stand in our way, and to everyone in the 7th Congressional District, that change isn't waiting any longer. We have arrived. Change is coming, and the future belongs to all of us.
That was Ayanna Pressley after beating a 10-term incumbent and winning the Democratic primary for Massachusetts' 7th District. And because she had no Republican challenger, she's headed to Congress in January and is one member of the new and diverse delegation of women who won election this year, numbering 34 so far. Four women candidates for Congress in Pennsylvania, all Democrats, are headed to Washington, ending the state's all-male delegation. The first Muslim and Native American women were elected to Congress this week. Tennessee elected its first female senator, while South Dakota and Maine elected their first female governors, and I could go on. So why did so many women candidates do so well, and what are the challenges and opportunities that await them when they start their new jobs? We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Let me introduce them to you. Kelly Dittmar is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics, author of a book called A Seat at the Table, Congresswomen's Perspectives on Why Their Presence Matters. And Kelly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Also with us, Anthea Butler, and she's a professor of religious studies and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Anthea Butler, nice to have you with us from Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Dawn Teal. She's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in women and politics, also the author of Forging the Franchise, The Political Origins of the Women's Vote. Dawn Teal, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And to our listeners, you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation anytime during this hour. Where to begin and who to begin with? Let me begin with you, Kelly, and then I, of course, want all of us to weigh in on this, just to take a moment to underscore this moment or mark this moment that we're in, seeing really an unprecedented number of women and diverse women that got elected this year. What does that tell us?
Yeah. So obviously we have a record number of women who are going to serve in the next Congress. We're well over 100 now. We know at least 125 women will serve. That's about 23.5% are getting close to there. We currently have 20% of women in Congress, so it's a gain. We also have to remember, of course, that we have a lot more work to do to get closer to parity. If women are over 50% of the population, we should probably be close to that in our representation in Congress. But as you noted, among the women who won, a real diverse class of women, and particularly when it came to race and ethnicity. Almost half of the women, Democratic women in Congress next year, will be women of color. The same is not true on the Republican side. We will see a decline in Republican women's representation.
Interesting.
And that diversity is not great either. So it's a dual sort of report from Tuesday, which is for women overall, we are seeing important gains that'll change the look and the content and substance of Congress. But we also have more work to do for all women and especially for Republican women.
How do you see the results, Anthea?
I see it as a fantastic win for women in America right now. I think one of the things that has been missed in all of this is that a lot of women don't have the money to get into these campaigns, and that this has been grassroots efforts. And from the smallest thing of state legislatures all the way up to Congress and the Senate, having women in these places are going to make a very big difference. And I'm thinking about right now about my own hometown of Houston, Texas, where 18 African-American women became judges. That is fantastic. That does not happen in Houston, okay? And so what that means is that there's a groundswell that's happening, and I think we should sort of not just focus in on what this means for this midterm, but what it might mean in 2020.
Looking ahead to the next election. Let me get your thoughts, Dawn, and if I can just add something. Does the fact that we have a President Trump, does that have anything to do, do you think, with the numbers of women running?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, Political scientists have a lot of theories about stasis. So what are the things that cause women to run for office in a steady state? But we don't really understand massive surges, but we have seen that with Trump. So the reaction to having somebody who's openly misogynist in office has galvanized the candidacies of a lot of women. And I think also, you know, the legacy of Obama has galvanized some of the grassroots mobilization for people of color in cities all across America.
What does it tell us, though, Kelly, about voters? I mean, people don't win unless people vote for them.
Right.
But what is that? What do the results tell us about what voters are saying?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there have been folks asking if this is a referendum on Donald Trump, and it surely is at least a referendum on the culture of politics that Donald Trump has put forward, which is both engaged in some of the misogyny that Dawn referenced, as well as the racism. And there are people in terms of voters who are really standing up and saying, I need my voice to be heard in the system. And so I'm not going to stand by and sort of watch this shift happen. I'm going to stand up and speak out. It started on day one with the Women's March, but it's continued in a variety of forms of participation, not only activism, but also mobilizing as volunteers on campaigns, giving money to campaigns at a rate that we haven't seen before among women, and then running for office. Mm. Candidates who are saying, I'm going to run, I'm going to translate my activism into candidacy.
Let me quote something I quoted off the air, but I do want to quote it on the air. And then, Anthea, I'll turn to you. This has to do with the Pennsylvania race for both governor and Senate. Governor Wolf got 65% of the women's vote. Senator Casey got 63% of the women's vote. But Casey got 95% of the black women vote, and Wolf got 96%. Help us understand perhaps this connection between the Democratic Party and black women.
The Democratic Party is black women. And if the Democratic Party does not begin to pay more attention to African-American women's concerns, those votes might go somewhere else in 2020. That's number one. Number two, I think it's really important is like there's a joke phrase that we all say is like black women tried to tell you. And we've been trying to tell you that this is the way that you should vote. And what annoys me greatly is that we pay so much attention to a voting bloc like evangelicals, but what we should really be paying attention to is this solid voting bloc of African-American women. Between the women that came out to vote and the women who now gain office that are African-American women, there is a groundswell. And this reminds me of sort of like when we went into the 70s, when you started to see more African-American leadership and mayorships and things like that. That's kind of like what I feel like this is now, is that it's going back to something that happened post-civil rights movement, where we saw a lot of African-Americans gaining office. But this time it's African-American women. Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing to see alongside of how white women are voting. We can talk about that in a little bit.
We will get to white women. Let me quote Ayanna Pressley, who I played the clip of her winning the Democratic primary. She says, we have to have a conversation about the guts and soul of the party. And if I can put that to you, Dawn, do you see the numbers of diverse women coming into Congress that there needs to be some kind of soul searching among Democrats and certainly the party leadership?
Definitely. And I think that a lot of these women are more progressive than the Democratic Party has been on average. You know, the sort of Bernie Sanders momentum has allowed people to speak unabashedly about socialism and, you know, the fact that we need to do what's right. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, as I like to call her in my mind.
Good for you.
You know, she is the future in many ways because she's young, she's energetic, she is not apologetic about a future for socialism in America, and I think that has the potential to push the Democratic Party more to the left. A lot of people think that they are already incredibly liberal, but it's actually not historically true. The Democrats have been trending toward the center, and the Republicans have been trending towards the right. And so I think a lot of people, especially those of us who believe in social progressive politics, want more AOCs.
Do you think, Kelly, there'll be then a fight within the Democratic Party over these particular issues?
Yeah, I think there's going to be tension in the new House. And there's going to be tension between the sort of establishment leadership and these new members. And these new members are going to also realize they don't have as much power as they may have felt on the campaign trail. There's a lot of energy around them, but they come in as junior members. So there will be some of the in-family discussions that will have to be had at the beginning of the next Congress. And I just want to add on in terms of the Democratic Party and what the Democratic Party needs to do. One thing that you don't want to overlook is the extreme dearth of women of color in statewide executive offices. And so Stacey Abrams, in particular, Michelle Lujan Grisham, really pushed against that narrative that women of color cannot win white majority areas, whether it be a district or a state. And so I hope that what the message is sent to the Democratic Party, both nationally and in states, that we have to be looking to women of color as very viable and valuable candidates at that level as well, because those numbers are still very low.
And we should say that Abrams and Kemp, there is a recount taking place because the vote is so close. Anthea, let me turn to you and let's talk about white women. Again, some quotes here. 51% voted for DeSantis. That would be in Florida. 76% of white women voted for Kemp over Abrams. 59% of white women voted for Cruz over Beto O'Rourke. And 53% voted for Trump 2 years ago.
What's going on, white women? I mean, I guess the question is that this idea about patriarchy and what we think, you know, liberal feminism should be is not sinking in with white women's votes, okay? And so the question that I have, and I'm not sure, I'm not the politician person, but I think as a person who studies religion, is that part of what we see is that these women who are white women who are voting for these Republican candidates are voting their best interests of protection. They're voting the way their husbands told them to vote. They are voting for their way of life, and they don't really feel any empathy for anyone else. Hmm. And that's really strong
that's a bold
to say.
Statement.
But I'm going to say it. I said to somebody, I said, you know, I think that if you came out of this election and you voted Republican, you might have to say that you also are voting for racism. And so I'm wondering that we need to look at white women and say, are white women voting for racism? Are they voting for patriarchy? Are they voting for the status quo? This cannot be spoken about anymore, especially for white women in terms of economics, because that's not what's driving this.
But there is no kind of universal female experience. I'm looking at you, Dawn.
Absolutely. And I think Anthea's right that a lot of this comes down to white women voting. I think the national election results show that 49% of white women voted for the Democratic Party and 49% voted for the Republican Party, so slightly different than the previous presidential election. But it's a time-old problem, you know, anti-suffragists. Mm-hmm. There were huge anti-suffragists. It was a huge movement. Talk about that a little bit in my new book. But the fact is, I think this is gendered class interest. So it is about the economics of it. If certain women are less likely to be in the workforce, they're more dependent on the system supporting male incomes being higher than female incomes. They're more supportive of a system where, you know, men who are accused of things can't, you know, get off slightly more easily as a result of that. And so I think that this is a class problem as well as as well as a race problem.
We're almost having a break here, but Kelly, I know you want to add something.
Yeah, I think, but we also have to be clear that there are also just very different gendered attitudes among women. So if you look at some of our colleagues who've done work on hostile sexism,
absolutely,
they show that those beliefs are more common among Republicans, men and women, than they are among Democrats. So that you see Republican women saying, well, sexual harassment, false allegations are more of a problem, right? So those types of things are very real differences in how they view gender and gender equity.
Well, let's take a short break, and I'm sure folks want to join our conversation. That's Kelly Dittmar from Rutgers University, also from the Center for American and Women for American Women and Politics. Dawn Teal is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in women and politics. Anthea Butler, also at the University of Pennsylvania, professor of religious studies and Africana studies. And we are talking about the numbers of women who won elections this year and what to make of it. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoeng talking with our guests about the midterm elections, the historic vote for female candidates, more than 100 women elected to the House of Representatives, and a wave of victories for women across the country, including for Democrat Charisse Davids. And here she is speaking Tuesday night after defeating Republican incumbent U.S. Representative Kevin Yoder in Kansas.
The core of this campaign has been about trying to figure out ways to make sure that as many voices and experiences as possible that we have in this community are being heard by our elected representatives. And we have to make sure, I have to make sure, my job as the soon-to-be representative of the 3rd District is to make sure that it doesn't matter if you cast your vote for me or you cast your vote for Kevin Yoder, come January, I see every single person. I listen to every single person.
Kelly, she's a really interesting candidate, a lawyer, a Native American. She's a lesbian. She's a lawyer. She's a mixed martial artist on top of that. Yeah. She's got it all covered here. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think it's important to look at women like Charisse Davids and the identities, the multiple and layered identities that they bring and the experiences and perspectives that that's going to bring to Congress. Too often when we talk about quote-unquote identity politics, we're talking about the number of women or the number of women of color, the pushback is, well, you're just counting beans, right? You're just saying, why do you care so much about the demographic identity of these individuals? We care because that translates into perspective and experience that's not at these tables currently. And with Charisse Davids, she will be one of the first Native American women ever to serve in Congress. And so when you think about the policy discussions that have been had for hundreds of years without a Native American woman's perspective at the table, whether it's violence against women, which that was a huge debate the last time we did the VAWA, or it's about tribal issues, you don't have that perspective there. So, you know, she and Deb Haaland and the diverse women that are entering this Congress are going to bring those perspectives to conversations and in ways that we might not even know until policies come forward and these debates happen.
Well, Dawn, let me toss this to you, but Anthea as well. But are there women's issues when it comes to politics or it comes to serving in government?
This is obviously a key debate among feminists, what it means to speak for and represent women. And a key sort of contribution of intersectionality theory has been this idea that liberal feminism as it stands is white liberal feminism. And so definitely I don't think we can collapse all issues into women's issues. But I do think that there are, among the women who have served in legislative office, there are certain key issues that stand out as important. And among those running now, healthcare has been a big issue. The opioid crisis has been a big issue. Guns and violence against women. These are all things that women have been more likely to advocate for when they are in national legislatures.
How do you see it, Anthea?
I see it as it's not just women's issues, too. It is a question of intersectionality, but I think how women deal with these issues is really important. So I think about somebody like Charisse Davids being there. How you deal with LGBT issues might be very different than how someone else would deal with those issues, right? And so I think that's where the intersectionality comes in, first of all. And it's secondarily, if there are such a thing as women's issues, right? Because I think there's issues that affect us all as human beings. I think that women are best poised to speak more eloquently and in some ways very more pointedly than some men would, because basically it's sort of like this has gotten ignored. And I think with the parade of men that we have seen in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, this is going to be a breath of fresh air, and it'll probably make President Trump go crazy, because every time he has to talk to a woman, that's usually a problem for him.
Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Can I just raise one example? So when we were writing our book about the impact of women in Congress, one of the conversations that came up repeatedly was the advocacy of women on sexual assault in the military, sort of addressing this problem, serious problem. It wasn't until the number of women went from 1 to 7 on the Senate Armed Services Committee that this became a sustained conversation. There were multiple committee hearings. There were multiple pieces of legislation, in fact, by women who disagreed on the solution. But the point is that conversation was being had in a way that it wasn't before, because simply nobody at the table had brought it up.
We have more than 100 women are going to be serving in Congress. So do you see more issues like this being brought up or having an actual life to them?
Yeah, I think it's certainly possible that they're going to expand the agenda of items that we're talking about. When we spoke to women of color, that's one thing they said to us. We expand the agenda. We don't have our own agenda, but we expand it. So I think we will see the possibility for that. But we do have to remember that, especially in the Senate, women will be a small number of the majority. So those setting the agenda are those in the majority party. So a lot of that is more likely in the Democratic House.
Anthea, let me pick up on something you said. You were talking about white women. And essentially, it sounded like you were saying that women should vote Democratic that if you're an evolved woman, you would vote Democratic?
I hate to say it, but I think that's the case.
Why?
I mean, I think it's the case because a lot of times when if we're talking about an old Republican Party back in the 80s or even the 70s, 60s, I would say, okay, maybe you want to vote Republican. But right now, because of the change that has happened with President Trump, this party has changed. This party is broken. It is now the party of racism. It is the party of misogyny. It is the party that is against immigration. It is a reactionary party. And so I think back to where people were saying the Tea Party is over and everything else. The Tea Party got subsumed in the Republican Party. That is what it is. And so as a place for women, if you are a Republican woman right now, and I'm thinking about the African-American woman in Utah, Mia Love, who spoke out against Trump when he called, you know, Haiti an asshole, right? And now he said, well, you didn't embrace me. And so what you have to do is you have to realize that if you're going to embrace the Republican Party, you got to embrace the racism. You got to embrace the sexism. You got to embrace all of that, that it encompasses this particular Republican Party. So that's why I am not, you know, persuaded by the fact that voting Republican is in anyone's best interest.
Interesting. Let me read some emails, and then we've got Madeline Dean waiting in the wings. One from Jill. There's already talk about 2020 presidential ticket. I have liberal friends who feel a progressive woman must be on the ticket. Other liberal friends actually say a tried and true white man like Joe Biden at the top would be the best way to unite the country. I'm going to put that aside. We'll try to get back to that. Also, an email from Phyllis. Be sure to mention that the next election is not 2020. In 2019, Pennsylvanians elect local county government judges and municipal offices. Local and county elections are not off years. Thank you, Phyllis, for saying that. Well, there have been no women in the Pennsylvania congressional delegation since 2014, but that will change next year when four Democrats head to Washington. They call themselves the Fab Four: Mary Gay Scanlon, Susan Wild, Chrissy Houlihan, and our guest Madeline Dean, who beat Republican Dan David to win the 4th congressional district. And Madeline Dean, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, I'm pleased to join you, Marty, and the other women.
Absolutely. You served, you're still serving in the legislature in Harrisburg for 6 years. Why did you want to run for the U.S. Congress?
After the election of our current president in 2016, I was looking for a way to expand my public service. And then as a result of the Supreme Court decision in Pennsylvania, drafting all new fair congressional districts, I recognized this was my chance. So it was a historic sort of meeting of my 6 years of legislative experience, a fair district in my home county of Montgomery County, and these very difficult times with our current president.
And if you could talk to our current president, what would you say?
I hope that the current president could learn from what these elections, I think, said in terms of the record number of people who turned out. The record number of women who turned out, the record number of women who just became elected, both in the congressional level but also down ballot. What I heard at the doors were people were concerned about a lot of things, bread and butter issues like health care and educating their kids and economic development. But the number one thing that people cared about and talked to me about is decency.
Interesting.
They wish that this president and that political leaders would speak to one another with decency, would legislate and perform their public service with decency, speaking even when you are opposed to one another, speaking to one another with respect, prizing the facts, and stopping the bigotry and fear-mongering hatred, frankly, that we hear from this administration.
Do you think your gender mattered to voters?
I know it did, and I have to say, Marty, when I first ran for office in my 50s, I never have said to somebody, vote for me because I'm a woman. I don't think that is the reason to vote for me or for any other candidate. But certainly in this election cycle, Pennsylvania went from having no women in its federal delegation of 18 congressmen and 2 senators to having 4 of us get across the finish line. And so I know people are striving to correct the inequality in representation. It was really exciting to run in this race and to run collectively with women. I think that's pretty unprecedented. We actually worked together in some select joint fundraising agreements. We called ourselves the Fab Four. And I think we did it in a spirit of a rising tide lifts all boats. So that was really fun. And I also want to mention what impact it had down ballot. Is that all right if I do that?
Yeah, sure is. And I've got three guests here who I know want to jump in. I've got some questions for all of you. But Madeline Dean, go ahead. Down ballot, yes.
In this election cycle, I think you saw a real collaboration, a coordination among the Democratic candidates from Governor Wolf, Senator Casey, the congressional races, on down to the important state House and state Senate races. And right here in Montgomery County, we saw women taking out long-term sort of dynasty state senators and state representatives. And I think that was absolutely a recognition by voters that we need greater balance in all levels of government.
Well, it's interesting. You said you had so much fun running for office, because I think for a lot of people, they feel like what an onerous task that is. And I wonder, I'll put this first to you, Dawn Teal, about how, and maybe this has changed, how women candidates are often viewed, how they are covered. I'm thinking of, you know, if a woman raises her voice, she is shrieking. Is that still how women are often defined?
Well, Trump's own use of the term shrillery tells you all you need to know. So I think that the sort of sexism is alive and well in the way that we discuss female candidates. A lot of people discussed, you know, Hillary as being not warm, not friendly. She doesn't bake cookies. So these are always issues. They remain issues in the American
Party. Yeah. What about for you, Kelly?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that the goal of this year is not to say mission accomplished when it comes to gender and politics, right? That we saw, in addition to the success of women, we saw some of the remnants of that sexism, of that racism. We talked about Charisse Davids earlier. She had been the subject of many attacks, both on her sexuality, on being Native American. So these things are persistent in our system. But the volume of women in terms of numbers and their success and the support for them means that we're calling it out and we're problematizing it. That's the first step to making it a little bit easier for the next women who run.
How about for you, Anthea?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I find interesting, and I just want to sort of address this to Madeline, congratulations, first of all. And then secondarily, I think we've paid attention a lot to the young women in this campaign, but we haven't paid attention to middle-aged or older women who have run. And I'm thinking about women who are over 50 who are jumping into the political arena for the first time. And I think that this is a very big change. We never talk about this when it's white men doing this. It's like it's just the, you know, the average thing that they're supposed to do. But I think it is absolutely stellar that we have women who are still committed to public service that will do that. That's first of all. The second thing I think is about all of this is that what happens when women are involved is that you get a different ethical sense. And I am thinking about Madeline here because she's an ethicist. And so she's going to see this in a very different way than somebody who's just like, well, I've got to serve, you know, the NRA, or I've got to serve my, you know, my big, you know, donor constituency and all of this. I think that one of the things that we really need to pay attention to in this election cycle with all of these women is that they don't have those same kind of people backing them. And that's going to make a big difference in what happens in Congress.
Madeline, you want to respond to that?
Well, and I think that was something I observed in campaigning this election cycle, that the women that I ran with, and also, you know, we had some terrific male candidates as well who didn't get across the finish line, but they ran with a diverse background. As you say, they didn't come in with one agenda. They're not coming in backed by a single supporter. They brought their diverse background. So for me, for example, I was a lawyer as a young woman. In my middle career, I was an educator like you women. I taught at LaSalle University and taught young people about their words and their writing and ethics. But I knew in my 50s I always knew I wanted to serve, but I wanted to serve because I believed that public service is a high calling. And in so a meandering way, my background of advocating for clients or advocating for students really prepared me for the work of public service. And I think you're going to find the diverse backgrounds of these candidates, the women in particular that I had the chance to have some fun running with, really prepares them in a very meaningful way to do the work.
Let me ask you about Nancy Pelosi, and that, I guess, is the question that it gets asked of these candidates about whether you support her being Speaker of the House or whether you're agnostic or opposed. I'm just curious, Madeline, how you view her.
Thank you for the question. And I have to say, you can imagine I was asked this all during my run.
I'm sure you were, and I almost hesitate to do it. But it's important because she wants the job. She's had the job, and you know, some people like her, some people don't.
And I have to tell you, it's funny, as I pivot out of the State House, I literally met with the chair of the Southeast delegation of the Pennsylvania House. We have now just become the biggest delegation by far in the Democratic caucus. And so I was working with members existing and new to talk about our own leadership elections, which I will not have a vote in next week. And what my advice always is to them is to know exactly who's running and be thoughtful about your vote. The expression, keep your powder dry. So as I pivot to the federal leadership elections, I really look forward to them. I've had the chance to get to know Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and some of the other leaders, existing leaders, and some other members who are also running. And I'm a great admirer, and specifically about Nancy Pelosi. I'm an admirer of her hard work, her intellect, her team-building approach. And so I think very highly of her, but I will not be telling you who I'm voting for today until I know exactly who's voting.
No, fair enough. Dawn, anything you want to add to that?
Oh, no, I was just going to say that this, what Anthea and Madeline were talking about, this idea that you're called to serve, but you wait until later on, you have a career first, has been a tried and true pathway for women to political office. Kelly's colleagues, Sue Carroll and Kira Sambo-Matsu, have written a lot about the pathways to political office. And what I think is very interesting in this election, there's this idea that in the past you sort of paid your dues, you waited till you found the right thing to run for, you moved through local city councils before you did the state ledge, and then you did the federal thing. But we've actually seen some younger women just going for it in Congress. And so I think, you know, as an elder millennial, to borrow a phrase here, I'm very excited about some of these young women. At the same time, I think they have so much to learn from the more senior members there. I think there is an opportunity to shake it up because they don't have the same ties to the party. They don't have the same ties to voters. And so anything is possible.
Well, on that note, Madeline Dean, we have to say goodbye to you and congratulations and thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And she's a member of the legislature in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And come January, she'll be heading to the U.S. Congress, to the House of Representatives, representing Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District. We're going to carry on our conversation with Anthea Butler, a professor of religious studies and Africana studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Dawn Teal, assistant professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in women and politics. And Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and a scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics. We're talking about women in politics on Radio Times today. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking about the numbers of women who won on Tuesday night, and results are still coming in, and it looks like more than 100 women will be serving in the House of Representatives, most of them Democrats, and also about almost a quarter of the Senate will be made up of women. I should add that while Democrats added to their numbers, it looks like Republican women lost in that category. Let me play a Democrat, Ilhan Omar, speaking on Tuesday night after being elected to represent Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, and she is Muslim American.
When people were selling the politics of fear and division and destruction, we were talking about hope. We were talking about the politics of joy. And tonight I think about one of my mentors, my sister, someone I had the honor of serving with, who embodies the politics of joy, Representative Erin Murphy. And when I saw her tonight, I said that politics of joy was contagious. It seeped in into our soul, and it allowed us to use it as our North Star, to fight for the America we know we deserve.
And again, that was Ilhan Omar, Somali-born American, and she is going to be representing Minnesota's 5th Congressional district and talking about the politics of joy.
Yeah.
Kelly.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I think that what she's tapping into is, if you remember Michelle Obama after the 2016 election saying, you know, hope. Hope is what sustains us. Hope is what we need. And I think in this moment where this election was a sort of reckoning with what was happening in this country, that sort of message resonated with a lot of people. And I would add that it's not only the politics of joy that I think you saw from her and other candidates who were saying we can move past this, but there's a politics of resilience, and that's particularly true among the women of color candidates who are saying, look, we've experienced this before. This is not new. We didn't wake up after Election Day 2016 and all of a sudden realize this country had a problem with racism and sexism. We know, and we've been on the front lines when it comes to fighting these forces. And so I think the leadership of women like Ilhan Omar, but also many of the women of color candidates this cycle, will lead that sort of message and sentiment into the next Congress in the next 2 years.
And yes, I saw something, several headlines that said for black women candidates, they have to get through the ceiling on top of the glass ceiling. But
yes,
there's another ceiling beyond the glass ceiling.
Yeah, there's the ceiling that's the glass ceiling, and there's the ceiling of race. And that ceiling is really very hard to break. And I think what we've seen in this election cycle is something very different, and that is that these women are breaking through that. I think, you know, when people look at the governor's race in Atlanta, they just think, oh, Stacey Abrams, she couldn't have possibly gotten this close. But I think that the reason why she is so close right now and may even surpass her opposition is because people want to see something different. They want the politics of hope. They want the policy, the politics that, you know, what America is supposed to stand for, right? Democracy, you know, freedom, that anyone can come here and be what you want to be. And I think that Omar's case is something about that that really resonates with a lot of people, is that that's what we are. That's what we hoped to be as a nation. And that when we see all of the stuff that's been pushed back about, you know, racism and sexism and everything, and the hatred of immigrants, it's like a repudiation of what this nation's history is. And that I think that people like Omar and others are showing us that you can break through those double glass ceilings in a way, and that you can be a part of this democratic process.
Here's a tweet from Kate. She says, I take offense to the idea that I, a white woman, vote the way my husband tells me. I'm very intelligent, empathetic, and registered independent. I vote Republican because they are generally pro-life.
And if that's the only reason why you're voting pro-life, then I would ask you to think again, because there are other issues besides a fetus. And that if you are not thinking about, and I will address this to her very clearly, if you are not thinking about what happens after that baby gets here, how that baby is starving, how that baby might go to prison, how that baby won't get an education, then you are a single-issue voter who has no vision about what this nation should be.
But there's single-issue voters on both sides of the aisle. But Dawn, go ahead if you want to add something.
Well, I think Anthea said it just right. You can vote on a single issue, but let's talk about a cradle-to-grave welfare state. If we're going to impose extreme regulations on women's bodies, then we have to shell out the money at all levels, at all stages of life, healthcare, education, the environment, all of these things, so that we really are thinking about the future.
Yeah. Kelly?
No, I think that this raises a really important question, or I guess an important point, that women voters are not monolithic. And we've talked about this already, but I think that we have to really grapple with that when we're talking more broadly about the gender gap or what motivated women this year, to recognize that there are voters like those who are writing in or are calling in who are saying that narrative of a reckoning doesn't actually appeal to me because I was not concerned or I am happy with this president. And that doesn't that we should accept that just as much as we accept the diversity among men. We can be critical of it, but we also have to realize that women are as diverse as their male counterparts.
And entitled to their own opinion.
That's right. That's right.
Absolutely. I would never say she was not entitled to her opinion. I would just say that I would, you know, challenge that and say that, you know, in a time where it's very clear to me that evangelical voters, you know, I'm going to guess she might be one since she's voting pro-life, or, you know, a Catholic pro-life voter. If that is the only thing you're picking up, then what about all the rest of the things that have been wiped away that people have voted for like you in the past that you have ignored about this administration? That is where I would challenge you.
Let me read some more comments here. One from Margaret. Can your guests comment on whether Pennsylvania's recent redistricting map, contributed to the election of four new women to Congress? We spoke with Madeline Dean, one of those four women. Gerrymandering has been a huge problem in Pennsylvania, creating voting districts that don't represent our population. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court weighed in, essentially redrew these maps And voila, we've got more representation. I'm looking at you, Kelly.
Yeah, no, certainly. I mean, what is really interesting about Pennsylvania is that it may be a harbinger of what we see in 2022. So if we're all thinking forward and looking at opportunities for women to run and win, post-redistricting years are often the years where we have the greatest opportunity. So 1992, which was the year of the woman in terms of what people would
we
talk
keep
about.
Having these years couple of years. Right?
It was notable in terms of the largest freshman class until now. And part of that was due to those opportunities. So in Pennsylvania, what we saw was that the new map created opportunities in competitive seats where they hadn't been before. And Madeline Dean is just an obvious example of that. She wouldn't have run for that seat. It wouldn't have been a safely Democratic seat had those maps not been redrawn. So those structural changes are so important to thinking about opportunities to bring newcomers into the system.
A tweet from Victoria, she says, Hillary Clinton, who made addressing structural racism and sexism a major issue in 2016, said white women voted like their menfolk and was criticized for it, but that obviously is the case. How do we break through to get these white women to vote for women of color? Can I put that first to you, Dawn? And should that be the goal?
Well, my Americanist colleagues will all say that partisanship reigns supreme. So I think the issue is, from a very young age, people are socialized to believe in particular party positions. And so there's very little, I think, that we can do about that. But the conversation we're all wondering about is what happens at Thanksgiving.
That's true. We were talking about that. I mean, there's partisanship. Does that trump people's...
Maybe.
Views on race and sex.
I mean, I think the partisanship in part is partially racial. I can't help but think that. I mean, if you have a white population right now that thinks that they are the ones who are the victims and that they're being sold this bill of goods all the time and that we are the victims, then you vote the way you do because you think you are, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that this is something that has happened in the last, since the Obama administration, really, and that we haven't really reckoned with this. I mean, what annoys me greatly is that everybody wants to tiptoe around race, and I'm like, that is the elephant in the room, and unfortunately, the elephant is a racist Republican. Elephant, and that how do we talk about this? And I think also this is on the Democratic side for a lot, because basically, again, if the Democrats don't pay attention to their largest voting bloc, African-American women, then they've got a problem. Mm-hmm. They've got a race problem too. And that's interesting to me. I mean, this thing plays out in lots of different ways. I was thinking about when we started off with Ayanna Pressley. Everybody forgets that the CBC didn't really want to back her at first.
The Congressional Black Caucus
did not want to back her at first. And then they had to eat crow. And so I'm wondering what's going to happen when she gets to D.C. And now that, she remembers that they did not back her. So, we've got this happening in various kinds of ways. And I think those are the ley lines we have to really think about.
Well, I wonder too, Kelly, whether since we're hearing for a number of candidates and a number of voters, what happened on Tuesday was a vote against President Trump and against his administration. If he weren't there, would we have this number of women both running for office and getting elected?
Yeah, this is a tough one. I don't want to give Donald Trump all of the credit for women's political mobilization and success this cycle, but he certainly was part of it. I think I've talked about his election as a sort of catalyst for women who may have already been engaged and active, those who may not have been, who saw a sense of urgency with not only the election of Donald Trump and the rhetoric, the rhetoric that he brought forth, but also the dominance of a Republican Party in the executive and legislative branch, right? So when you had full GOP control, what that meant was a very real likelihood that the policy progress that many of these women valued would be pulled back. The policy progress that had been made under Obama would be pulled back. So I think as much as it's about Donald Trump to a certain degree in terms of shedding light on this problem and maybe exacerbating it, for many women, I think they would have been mobilized if any Republican had won the presidency because they would have been concerned about what that meant for policy change and policy agendas. And of course, this is the story of Democratic women, but those are the women who made up all of the surge and all of the gains in Congress.
Interesting. Here's an email from Brendan, excited about Pennsylvania's new representation in Congress. Who do your guests think should lead Congress other than Nancy Pelosi? I like Pelosi, but maybe it's time for a woman of color to lead, perhaps Maxine Waters. I'm back to you, Dawn. No, I'm back to you, Anthea. Everyone's pointing to
well,
Anthea.
Well, you know, if it's Maxine Waters, let me tell you what's going to happen. It will be an explosion because Trump will lose his, I mean, they will all lose it. I mean, and the Republicans are going to lose it. Trump's going to lose it. If it is Maxine Waters, I think she is someone that is just as qualified in a lot of different ways as Nancy Pelosi. She's been through the fire. She knows how to get people together. I don't know that I think that's going to happen as a provocative thought, and I'd be interested to hear what everybody else has to say. I don't think it's going to happen because I think she's much more powerful being on, I can't remember which committee it is that she
financial
might be on,
services.
Financial services, because that is where she can get those tax returns. She can do all of that, and I think, to me, that's a much more powerful use of Maxine Waters than being the chair.
And I think there are a number of members like that who actually probably don't want the job, right? It's not an easy job, and it's a job in which
herding
you,
cats, right?
Yeah, and you're going to have to go in and have these conversations with the president. And so as much as there is clearly tension between Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump, I actually do think they will sit down and have conversations and work the deal. I don't know how successful it will be, but that's something she's accustomed to.
Dawn, let me read an email from Ron who says, I consider myself a bleeding heart liberal Democrat, but I believe that if we rally around Bernie Sanders and socialism, the Democratic Party is doomed.
I guess my loyalty is not in any way to the Democratic Party. And I think, you know, we are due for a shakeup in the party system. We are due for a shakeup in the way that seats are apportioned across the states. We are headed towards big conflicts over the Senate in the future. Apparently, in 10 years, 60% of this population is going to live in five states. So, you know, for me, it's not about the Democratic Party. It's about the future of this country and the policies that we have going forward.
Do you see any change in the Electoral College or changes in how we elect senators if they're going to be such a kind of mismatch?
Just to go out on a complete limb here, I suggest that California gets broken into three states and that the several Midwestern states get grouped into one. I think that we need to think about proportional representation at the state level. So major electoral change. And I think PR has a bunch of advantages. The comparativist, well, I'll tell you that it also
has PR?
Proportional representation.
Gotcha.
So where party seats are allocated as a proportion of the popular vote that goes to them. So PR systems produce a lot more parties. Also, a lot more women get elected in countries that have PR than they get elected in countries like the United States, where it's winner-take-all rules. So I'm for a total overhaul. Democratic Party be damned.
Oh, interesting. Well, what are your thoughts,
Anthea? I mean, I don't want Bernie in anything, okay? I'm sorry. I just, you know, Bernie's remarks on race this week and everything else, I know people really see him as the, you know, the end-all be-all of what socialism is, but we've got other people who can talk about socialism. Bernie Sanders is done, okay? I'm calling it now. And I think that, you know, this looking again to white men to save us is not helping. And I will also just say this about somebody we brought up earlier, Joe Biden. This will probably get me in trouble at Penn. But, you know, until Joe Biden reckons with what he did with Anita Hill, he's going to have a problem with black women. And so I don't know if you want him running in 2020.
Oh, interesting. Kelly, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. But I also think, you know, when Dawn's talking about structural changes, I think those are really hard and unlikely in our system, right, to change the Constitution. But
you don't have to change the Constitution.
Well, for PR, you do.
No, you don't. It's just that the states have to have states have to be democratically elected. It doesn't say anything that they have to be
right,
first
that's
past
true.
The post system.
States
can
states
do it within the
elections.
States.
But I still think it's highly unlikely.
Well, we're in Pennsylvania, but
I still think it's highly unlikely.
Yeah.
I think what we can also do in a shorter term is ensure that everybody who can vote does vote. And actually can vote, right? I mean, so who is legally able to vote actually is able to exercise that right. And we saw this cycle, more attempts to try to reduce the right to vote, limit and constrain the right to vote among certain populations of people, particularly populations of color. If everybody could vote and voted at higher rates, we would actually see the Democratic success nationwide because the majority of the population is Democratic. The more diverse we become, the more Democratic the voter base. So in the short term, I do think there's things we can deal with when it comes to voter access and preventing voter suppression.
Yeah, and the last thing,
at
10 seconds, the last thing we've got to deal with voter suppression and gerrymandering. We cannot continue like this. It's part of what's going on right now with Republicans running around and trying to steal elections because they are, you know, the person who holds up all the polling booths and all of this other stuff. We really need to have a concerted effort to this for 2020 and 2022.
Anthea Butler, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. And she is Professor of Religious Studies and Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Dawn Teal, thank you for joining us as well. And she's an Assistant Professor of Political Science, also at the University of Pennsylvania. And Kelly Dittmar, thanks for coming in. And she's an Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University, also scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics. And we appreciate all those comments to Radio Times. You can also carry on the conversation after the show. Check out our Facebook page. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. I know Adam, actually. Yes. And the show is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.